Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week, I'm taking you backstage in a world disrupted. We feature interviews with leaders in Washington and around the globe who can help us understand an international world that can seem like it's spinning out of control. Join me every Monday for new episodes. Subscribe, rate us, write a written review on Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast platform. And you can always email me at sglasser@politico.com. And now to today's show. Our guests this week, we're very lucky to have both Ambassador Samantha Power and Ben Rhodes joining us. An unlikely buddy movie pair, if there were. No, but seriously, this is such an interesting project and such an interesting timing to have a movie, almost like a document from another era in our life. We're having this conversation here in Washington, not quite exactly 1 year after the inauguration of President Trump. The movie ends with the inauguration of President Trump. I won't spoil the ending for those of you who...
He wins.
Well, yes, actually, okay, so Samantha, we might as well start with that then, that probably the most memorable scene to some people, certainly my son really looked up with this incredible moment of election night in your big apartment in New York City where you're the ambassador to the United Nations. Tell us about that scene.
Well, I've had a lot of bad ideas in my life, but none as immortalized as this one. I decided on election night to invite the 37 women ambassadors to the UN, many of whom face struggles in their own sort of foreign service or at the UN of a kind that, as America, I never did. And I thought, what an amazing night for them. I mean, that's what America represents to the world. When a glass ceiling is shattered in our country, it creates a whole new sense of possibility for people everywhere. And so I invited them. Most of them came. And we gathered with Madeleine Albright, our first woman Secretary of State, Gloria Steinem, who is not only an icon here, of course, but all around the world. And we went through the same process, if you want to call it that, that so many people did at their election parties. You know, as the host, I was kind of hoping it wouldn't be quite the blowout that it was anticipated to be, because I wanted to make sure that, you know, people had a chance to interact with Gloria Steinem and want to
milk. So your concern was actually that the evening was going to be over early.
Too soon. I wanted to milk the soft power dividend of this moment. And instead, and HBO was there, I guess, unfortunately or fortunately, to capture it all. But instead, you really see what so many people went through, which was all of that sense of promise and excitement and, frankly, a dose of complacency. And then it slowly dawning on us that not only was this going to be much closer than anybody anticipated, but that it was not going to end well. And for me, every time I see that, I am haunted most actually by the images of my children who are running around the apartment for much of the night. But when the election is called, my daughter, who at that time is 4, is just lying in my lap, you know, kind of like this pale Irish statue. And there's something about the way she's lying, I don't know, that just makes her look like what he does is on her, right? It's like we've somehow collectively, you know, landed in this place, but the people who are going to feel this and be affected by this are these innocents, you know. And as it happens, I was looking at a young child, but there's so many other innocents who are being subjected to the cruelty as we speak here today. But yes, I think that scene moves viewers the most because it triggers, I think, a kind of post-traumatic stress about their own election night experience, which
speaking
mirrored
of post-traumatic
mine.
Stress, Ben, you seemed like you were having not post-traumatic, but actual, like you couldn't speak. where were
for
you?
For Ben Rhodes not to be able to speak.
I know,
you know,
no,
really,
and the fact
really
that you kept the camera on.
Yeah, no, I was actually a little after the election, but close enough that I was still digesting it. And Greg asked me, you know, my thoughts. And as people who know me, I, probably to a fault, am usually not without thoughts and words. You know, I think I kept beginning to say something. And the film shows that basically I can't speak, because anything I was going to say was just going to be kind of a lame rationalization, you know.
Right.
And when in reality, you know, sometimes things are just terrible. And I think that the two layers of feelings that I had after the election, you know, one is just on a very personal level, you know, we just spent 10 years, you know, watching the film, it's like watching yourself run the 26-mile marathon, and to just feel, you know, and President Obama used to describe it as we're going to hand off the baton, and it's like you could see someone reaching back to take the baton, and suddenly nobody's there, you know, because personally you're feeling like, well, all these things I worked on, you know, what's going to happen to them? And the sense of, you know, you put all this time and effort and caring into different things that are now going to be threatened or attacked or undermined in some ways was powerful. But then more broadly, I think, beyond just me personally, was a sense of the unknown. I mean, that's why I didn't have anything to say. Like if Jeb Bush was elected president or even Marco Rubio, I wouldn't have liked that, but I could have foreseen what was going to happen and what that was going to look like. You know,
but that's why I said it's almost like a document from a different era.
It is,
because that unknown continues today, a year later.
That's right. And it's like a time capsule. I mean, what's so interesting about the twist ending is not great for the world, but it's great for the film, because now suddenly it's like this document from another age. You know, it's like watching something. It doesn't feel like a year ago. It feels like a decade ago.
Right. So that's why I thought it was good to start with this. You know, also it is the sort of dramatic like highlight of the movie, but that's the place that we're in is from that moment forward now. And so obviously your whole record, not just from the last year of President Obama's tenure, but all 8 years, is really thrown into uncertainty as well, because we don't know the ending. You would think you know the ending because Obama left office, but in fact we don't. The story of your foreign policy accomplishments is still very much up in the air. So a year later, you know, how much do you feel like that picture is being filled in? You know, obviously, some of the things Trump said he would attack on the campaign trail, he has. He's withdrawn from Paris, although we don't exactly know what the long-term consequences. Withdrawn from TPP. He's certainly not active on any of the issues that you really spent your time on at the United Nations. How do you each feel about where Obama's record is right now?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'd say two things. I mean, one is, you know, what Trump has done is in some ways not surprising. You know, he's, you know, partially rolled back Cuba. He's pulled out of Paris. He's threatened to kill the Iran deal, but not done it. But what's been worse to watch, I think, is like underneath that, you know, the hollowing out of the State Department, the defunding of all the types of programs that Samantha and I fought to get money for, you know, to help peacekeeping or to help promote education around the world, the kind of unseen elements of American foreign policy that underpin the liberal international order. That's where the year has been much worse than I imagined. I anticipated him kind of taking aim at some of our legacy accomplishments, but it's more this disavowal of an entire approach to the world that is not just Obama. It's fairly, you know, bipartisan over the decades. What I like about the film is, on the one hand, it's hardest to watch the good moments, you know, because I was very proud of Cuba, and it's now sad to see that partially roll back. But on the other hand, it does remind you in the long term, you know, here's what, part of what we were doing is like an approach to foreign policy, and you know that is an approach that can be returned to, and the Paris Accord is how the world is going to deal with climate change, and they can return to that. And Cuba, you know, the embargo should be lifted, and the next president can do that. So it does remind you that, you know, the pendulum can swing. And just as this year the pendulum has swung incredibly dramatically away from what we did, seeing the other approach does remind you that beyond kind of the scorecard and, you know, Paris, Cuba, TPP, Iran, there's an approach embedded in the film of just how to engage the world and how to conduct diplomacy that is available as an option to return to.
Although, interestingly, Samantha, some people do make the argument that Trump, obviously he's a very different person in every way than President Obama, but that he represents maybe a funhouse mirror version of some of the themes that were struck during the Obama years when it comes to America can't be sort of the hyperpower, it can't go around solving other people's problems. This question that you struggled with and struggle with, not just in the last year, but throughout the administration, of where is American intervention appropriate? You know, what does America first mean? Again, these are super different people, but here in Washington, there has been a conversation around whether there's some odd continuity between some of the themes struck by President Obama and President Trump.
Well, I think that there's something very, very different about President Obama investing in alliances, building a hypercharged, different kind of relationship with China and with India, and then drawing on that political capital to get them to do more in the international system than holding our allies in contempt, ripping up international treaties, showing our word means nothing, and then demanding that people do what we say. So I don't see a lot of continuity. I mean, there needed to be more balance in the international order. Europeans had to get back into peacekeeping and not expect the United States to just shoulder the load. And we pressed them to do that, and they have, and they need to do more. And
right, but you just didn't say in crude terms, you know, pay up,
you're
ripping
us off. They told us to sand, yeah, if that's how we had treated them. I mean, countries in many ways are a lot like people, like anthropomorphized versions of people. They don't like to be held in contempt. They don't like to be yelled at. And part of the alchemy of foreign policy is making, how do you make countries do what they don't really want to do very much? And alienating the democratic publics in, you know, those countries, again, that are democracies, where those leaders need their publics to go along with them in order to be able to do things that the United States wants, is a surefire way to really limit what other countries can do when you're in a bind. So the Trump administration, you know, there is a strand that we've seen through American foreign policy that they're drawing upon, which is a kind of cafeteria style approach to the global order, which is, you know, they go to the cafeteria and they just want what they want. They're going to have the apple pie and the vanilla ice cream, and that's it. They want it, and they don't think at all about the context in which they are going to take. And I think the Obama approach, and one, as Ben said, that has been shared by many other presidents who have come before, is to think systemically about how do you put money in the bank so that then when you go to draw money in a pinch, when you want to build a 60-country ISIS coalition, or when you want to get China to make commitments it's never made on climate change, you know, giving something up at an important stage of its development, you have something to draw upon. This administration currently is just draining money from the bank with needless insults and sort of gratuitous steps away from things that really seem derived more from a formula of how can we do the opposite of what Barack Obama did than even a considered, coherent approach. I don't see a huge amount of continuity.
Yeah. No. I think it's...
Well, I can, Susan, if I may, I mean, as someone who probably... you know, was in that argument a bit. If I understand the point people make that there is some overlap. You know, Obama thought that we had kind of exhausted a certain degree of the use of military force in the Middle East, but the irony is that we drew the exact opposite conclusion from Trump, because essentially, yes, you might say there was a vein of criticism that we were overextended, that there needed to be more balance in the international order and less American share of the burden in terms of military intervention in the Middle East. But the lesson Obama took from that is we need to be everywhere.
Right,
invest in diplomacy, institutions. Invest in alliances and institutions and spread it around and spend 7 years on an Iran deal so you don't have to get in another war. And so the irony is that Trump is basically... Well, first of all, he hasn't done what he said he would do. Militarily, he's escalated every conflict he was in. But even if you take that commonality, you know, the America First approach, if that is their organizing principle, is the opposite of where Barack Obama took that lesson. He took that lesson to what's in the movie, which is we need to be in like Laos and Vietnam, because that's how we're going to have to deal with China. Not we're going to retreat from TPP and get out of Asia.
Right. The word diplomacy appears so many times in this, and it's that's one of the biggest ironies, I think, in the context of the world we're living in right now, is that is at the heart of what you were trying to do.
And now a word from a sponsor.
So in the movie, Greg and I were just talking before we started our podcast, The Filmmaker, and, you know, it's like there are these twin themes, almost like the shark, you know, you see the fin, you see the, you know, and that Trump and the fact that the election might not turn out the same way, and Syria, right? And so, you know, again, early in the movie, it's just maybe a little glimpse, right, in the water of the fin. So
with Russia as the connector of the two.
Well, exactly. And we can talk about Russia in that context. Sergei Lavrov definitely has a few cameos in this film. But let me ask about Trump, too, because that is the question of President Obama's record and how it will be judged, given what came afterwards. Ben, there's this very memorable moment where, you know, you're asked, I think you're first asked about him in May in this film, and then in September. And you say, basically, well, I'm certain he won't win. That's the first thing. And then the second one is, I've never even entertained the possibility of him winning. And this is in September of 2016, when the polls are starting to show, actually, that he's closing against Hillary Clinton. Do you think that the inability of all of us, not just you guys personally, to see and to understand that Trump was certainly within striking distance and could win the election is part of what dictated the outcome?
No, I mean, even when I'm saying that, like, my face isn't quite as confident as my words. there's a bit of a fear. I mean, look, I did not think he was going to win. When I look back on this and wrestle with this, I mean, I personally feel like Trump didn't appear out of thin air, that as someone who went through the 10 years, there was this vein, you know, Sarah Palin, Tea Party, birtherism, you know, there was this kind of vein in our politics. Like, when Samantha and I were on the campaign together, the very beginning of the Buddy movie, it was forwarded emails. Like, you know, it was actually a problem for the campaign in 2008. We'd hear that we have to write, you know, responses to forwarded emails about a Barack Obama secretly Muslim or a terrorist or Kenyan. And that became like the Republican nominee by 2015, 16. I certainly thought that it was hard when in foreign policy, you spend so much time thinking about other countries that you can forget that, like, the most important thing is our own country. In other words, you know, we are scrambling the last year to kind of protect and build upon and burnish, you know, get the Paris Agreement enforced, get other countries to come into Paris. We can't think as foreign policymakers about, like, how do we keep our own country in Paris? And it was a lesson. The election was a reminder that there's no more important element of our foreign policy than who we are at home. I don't know what that means we could have done differently in retrospect, but it does suggest that, I was kind of a bit on the political side of things too. And so people would say, well, you know, is that bad? You know, someone should be wholly pure in foreign policy. But the reality is that if you don't have your politics right, you know, a foreign policy legacy is not going to be protected because you need to win elections. And, so again, I think that what we're all being reminded is, whether you're a foreign policy practitioner or someone who cares about issues around the world, that all begins with, like, who we are at home and how we organize ourselves politically, how we organize our communities, and who we elect as leaders. Because you can have all the best ideas in the world generated, you know, at a university or a think tank, but without the right people making decisions, that's not going to matter.
And the exchange that Ben and I have in the film over the General Assembly speech.
Yes, I want to get to that. That really is the
is pretty interesting now in light of what has happened, because the essence of our argument, and which President Obama was in as well on Ben's side of the argument, and so thus the prevailing side of the argument, alas, but was, you know, to sort of address the skeptics of globalization, you know, the people, but also the declinists, and to point to everything in the world that was trending in a positive direction.
So Obama makes this very upbeat, positive.
It ends up balanced.
But Ben, even in your description of this internal debate that you had over the speech, and you acknowledged in a way that Samantha's position was maybe more in tune with the times as they turned out to be. You said she, meaning Samantha, felt like that was potentially discordant with the mood.
One of the points I made to Samantha recently that actually is probably, part of what Obama is trying to achieve is that, yes, there are huge challenges. I mean, the basic point he was making is there are huge challenges in the world. There's 65 million people who are displaced. There's horrific conflicts like in Syria. But the global metrics, and this was just recently affirmed, you know, poverty rates are at their lowest and life expectancy is at their highest, that how do you meet the reality, the negative reality in the world, without actually becoming Donald Trump. You know, like, in other words, there you can overstate the troubles in the world in a way that actually suit the Trumps of the world. Because if everything is American carnage and this is the worst time ever and it's never been worse, if you succumb to that mindset, and I'm not suggesting that's what Samantha was saying. I'm suggesting that that's a trap that Obama was trying to avoid. Is if I'm up here saying everything is so terrible, well, I'm actually delivering Donald Trump's message. And I need to remind people, you know what, these are big challenges, we have to deal with them, but we're dealing with them in the context where globalization is doing extraordinary things in the United States and around the world to help people and raise standards of living. And we went through this, Susan, throughout the administration, where, like on terrorism, Obama constantly was trying to right-size terrorism in our national mindset and basically convey this is a huge problem. But ISIS is not an existential threat to America. Like, they're not going to take over. You know, if we become so fearful, we'll have Muslim bans and we will get into wars that we don't need to get into.
From your point of view, actually, what's happened over the last year essentially vindicates the Obama argument that you can't buy into the narrative because that helps to create it. But your point, Samantha, was a different one, which I found very interesting. As you characterized this very interesting, basically internal debate over the content of the president's final speech to the United Nations General Assembly, September 2016, that's one side of the argument that Ben's talking about. But you really framed it up as it is not in terms of politics, but that it's not the reality I'm living in. That's what I found very interesting. And you said something in there. I'm wondering how you feel about it today. You said, I'm not in the same place with the president anymore. And our worldviews are really different right now. And you listed sort of all these conflicts that were your reality at that moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't actually speaking about conflicting worldviews so much as I really do think where you sit is reflective of a lot of different things. And, you know, as...
If I was at the UN, I'd probably be making your argument, you know, yeah, I mean...
Maybe. I mean, just the inbox was a daunting one in terms of the amount of conflict and the sense that the countries that comprised our, you know, global order such as it is weren't stepping up and that states were getting weaker, not stronger. And, you know, that a lot of these development numbers are accounted for by a couple very big countries that pull a lot of people out of poverty, but that we were having a hard time wrestling to ground a set of problems and that there was a feeling of a kind of that the rules were mattering less rather than more. And whether that's because Russia invades Ukraine or, you know, bombs the daylights out of civilians in Aleppo, or because countries were turning away refugees at their doorsteps, not feeling as if they even needed to be part of European rules that had benefited them over the 20 years. Just a sense of kind of decay a little bit. And, you know, me flying commercial as I did, you know, by and large as UN ambassador with my kids, like in the time of ISIS, hearing people talk about the fear and even myself, like, you know, saying, okay, are our planes, you know, safe enough? And I think I just, I internalized the fear that I felt around me and wondered consistently, and Ben and I, but we've all struggled with this, how do we speak to that fear? You know, I went to West Africa at the height of the Ebola epidemic on President Obama's request, and I went in to show that we had nothing to be afraid of, that if we, you know, just abided by the protocols, that we could help these people, that we'd end the epidemic, and that would be good for the United States. When I got back, I learned months after I got back, in fact, that my son's classmates' parents had gone to the head of the school. My son went to the most international school in the city of New York and had asked that my son not be allowed attend school because his mom had gone to West Africa. And pretty much everyone at the school worked for the United Nations or some aid organization. So I'm in a world where even though we're the ones who have, you know, in principle anyway, faced our fears and gone into war zones and other things, but where that fear creeps in. And even though there was that great line, you know, that more Americans had married Kardashians than had died of Ebola, you know, we, as Obama formulated his response to the Ebola epidemic, had to find a way to talk about our response in a manner that spoke to what people were fearing. And so flash forward a couple years to our last General Assembly speech, I think our back and forth was a little bit, how do we meet people where they are with that the fear that we know that has been generated in part by
our politics,
lies and by our politics, but in part by, you know, actual legitimate fear and events. And how do we meet them where they are without indulging that fear and without giving in to that cynicism and that darkness? And you know, if you look at the average Trump voter, clearly we see now that there's a base of his support that is not going to go anywhere and that wants to stoke fears and that he's almost impermeable and can't be reached with facts. But there were a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump that certainly as we think about the next election, we have to think about how to reach.
And there were people who voted for Barack Obama, who in the end, right, 9 points, those were people who were your voters. But this is a very abstract conversation because the words you used in a UN General Assembly speech were big and sweeping. Some of the conflicts in the administration, were very real and very practical, especially on the question of Syria. And that comes up throughout this, not only the final year, but before that. And, you know, if there were kind of the push and pull between idealism and realism or pragmatism, I'm curious whether, with the benefit of hindsight right now, either of you have changed your views or you feel that the administration missed things along the way that it was harder to talk about then.
My views changed during the administration, over the course of the administration. And let me just say at the beginning of any discussion on Syria, like I think we all have to acknowledge, you know, nobody has 100% certainty that they have the right answer here, given the complexity of the issue, the range of options that we were looking at. I do think that what I was trying to speak to a bit in the film is, you know, I had been an advocate for military action in Syria very early, and I was kind of oriented in that direction. And you know, part of it was a pragmatic point about when does military intervention work? And the point I make in the film is that what Obama kind of tested in his mind and, frankly, in the congressional authorization debate in 12 and 13 is, can I create conditions where a military intervention can succeed? And if I don't have congressional support and I don't have international support and I don't have anybody giving me a plan that I can see working, how can I, in confidence, take the step of getting us into, you know, what could be a very, very costly and difficult war. And so part of that is that pragmatic function of, you know, it's not just a question of whether to go in. It's how will we do this? And if I'm going to do something that big as a president, you know, do I have the conditions to make sure that can work? The other point, though, that the film does interestingly is that, you know, I also, I felt like I had to learn from my own, you know, the experience I've looked at. And I didn't see us, you know, if I looked at Iraq and Afghanistan, I didn't see the capacity of the U.S. military to take out terrorists and to take out a target, but to influence events inside of countries with riven by sectarian division and questions about the role of Islam in politics and with external proxy forces. I didn't see how there was an evidentiary record that had worked.
Was it a mistake to stay in Afghanistan? Look at the Groundhog Day
I have to apply that lesson to everything. And I feel like there are diminishing returns about what we are accomplishing in Afghanistan. And at a certain point,
they asked President Trump to essentially make a very similar.
Well, and he escalated in a way that, you know, didn't seem big, but does basically mean that we're just going to stay at a slightly escalated place indefinitely. And the cost and lives and also just the fact that, is that working for Afghanistan? Because I know the case people can make, if we leave, X will happen. But if we stay, like, Y is happening. You know, it's not getting better. The corruption and the kind of nihilism in parts of the country. So all that is to say, I thought what the film did an interesting job of is kind of airing that there were different views, earnestly held, like people with good motivations, people trying to make moral choices can come to different conclusions. Greg also layered in that, you know, we were dealing with the legacy of U.S. interventions in Vietnam and Laos, where, you know, the cost of us saying we need to bomb a country for our own credibility is, you know, 40 years later, we've got 2 million unexploded ordnance in Laos. So it drew it out interestingly, but I also think it also obviously pointed to the extreme humanitarian catastrophe and geopolitical catastrophe of Syria, and the way in which we were out of options at the end of the administration is clearly not a satisfactory place to be. But
right. So Trump would say, "Well, we've defeated ISIS in my presidency, and you know, you guys were tied up in your own fights and didn't do it."
When we articulated our plan to defeat ISIS, we were very clear on the time frame, and it's actually really remarkable
exactly
the extent to which the time frame that Ben was out in public struggling to defend, because very rare, right, that the United States, we never do that. We don't come out and say, we will win this on this date.
Right,
and
it's far away. Trump critiqued that. Remember, he was always saying in the debates and stuff, guys are crazy. They're, you know, like signaling their
Ramadi,
plans in Mosul, right?
Yeah, we're going to.
It was very methodical.
And it actually happened on schedule.
And it's a credit above all, and this is true in our
military
administration and in the Trump administration, to Chairman Dempsey, Chairman Dunford, and the soldiers who are out there training Iraqi forces thanklessly, right, in these remote bases, supporting them with air power. So it's a very good thing that the caliphate is no more. What I worry about today is that when we were sitting in the Situation Room, it was always our military that was the most vocal about, okay, where's the money for demining? Where's the governance pressure? Initially on Maliki, then on Abadi in Iraq, you know, to be bringing in the Sunni and to be ensuring that we're doing away with the virus that gave rise to ISIS in the first place. You know, where is the respect for human rights? Where are the processes for accountability so you can distinguish real ISIS people from, you know, ordinary Sunni who got caught up in a firefight? And it was our military in the Situation Room that was saying, you know, we can do our part. Like, we can take territory. We know how to do that. We can kill bad guys. We know how to do that. But where are the other lines of effort? And I don't hear anything out of this administration. You know, John Kerry was, and Joe Biden were on the phone every day with Abadi, you know, trying to get the political equation right, trying to reverse de-Ba'athification all those years later after George W. Bush, so that Sunni felt welcome, so that there wouldn't be just more fertile soil for some future demagogue to come along and stoke people up. But that's the problem with gutting your State Department. That's the problem with not having allies, right? Is that you can't go tin cup in hand and get all those other countries to take on different slices of the post, you know, post-caliphate Iraq. And that's the problem with putting no energy behind bringing peace to Syria. I mean, one of the things that you know, I don't think we have our record on Syria is anything that any of us are particularly proud of. But when you see in this film that, notwithstanding the fact that nothing came out of it, the effort of Secretary Kerry, you know, there are scenes in the film where he can barely walk up the stairs with fatigue because he has been so busy shuttling from one place to the other, you know, trying to get the Iranians and the Russians and the Europeans and everybody on the same page. Can anybody articulate what our current Secretary of State is trying to achieve in the world beyond the number of jobs he's trying to cut at the State Department? I have no idea. And I think the film, you know, you could say it's a film about diplomacy. You could say it's a film that's a time capsule about Obama. But I think it's a film about caring, frankly, about what's going on around you in your life and in the world, in your community and in the world, and trying. And not always getting it right, and Syria is the best example of that, but the integrity of the effort and the relative, I know it's kind of sounds saccharine, but the relative purity of the motive for all of the differences among us on how to get things done. It's about trying to bring peace and make the world more stable.
Well, it's definitely a very, you know, it comes across as a very earnest or, you know, sort of transparent debate among people who are disagreeing on issues of principle. But there's nowhere, paradoxically, in the world where Trump has been received more positively by the leadership in the region than the Middle East, right? That's been the thing for any journalist who's talking to people, you know, over the last year, right? So what do you make of that? I mean, you know, there's not a lot of Israel and Palestine in this, for example. There's not a lot of Saudis. But, you know, they cheered.
Well, I'm troubled by it. Some of the things that have happened this year, interestingly, were things that that we were trying to forestall. In other words, the break with Qatar, you know, we basically had to spend a lot of time trying to prevent that from happening. The Yemen conflict, we, you know, spent a lot of time tapping the brakes and putting a halt on cooperation or transfers of certain weapons. And now it's just open season in Yemen, and what you're seeing is a huge humanitarian crisis. We tried to keep the Saudi-Iranian proxy conflict from completely overwhelming the whole region. And so my concern is that, you know, even though we are partners with the Saudis and the Emiratis, you know, that doesn't mean our interests are always entirely aligned. And basically what I see is an administration that has subcontracted out its view of regional conflicts in the Middle East to Mohammed bin Salman. And I don't think that leads in the right direction. I think it leads to the crisis, in the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. It leads to kind of this dysfunctionality in the GCC with Qatar. It leads to, you know, doubling down in support for Sisi and a kind of anti-democratic course in Egypt. And you know, on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, I think it leads to potentially like a situation where a Palestinian state is unrecognizable because of settlement activity and kind of just despairing on both sides. So, you know, I recognize you're right. I mean, the only place in the world where I think, you know, leaders have preferred Trump are in Riyadh and in Saudi Arabia and Israel.
And Russia.
In Russia, importantly.
And interestingly, actually, there's a scene where you say, you know, a longtime critique that you had of sort of the Washington foreign policy establishment. You say, you know, we've all heard you say this before, too. You know, it's not new to this film, that to the blob, Russia and the Middle East are basically the sum total of foreign policy. And if we're really going to have a global foreign policy, we need to be much more global. We need to think about Asia. But in a way, Russia and the Middle East remain, you know, at the heart of these problems. First of all, how do you feel about the Washington foreign policy establishment now? I mean, you know, they've been pretty resistant, even Republicans, to Trump far more so than other parts of the world. Is that just because they see Trump as anti-interventionist, or have they changed
your view? No. So let me say a couple things. First of all, the strategic consequences of leaving TPP, I think, are massive. Like, when I think of the things that Trump has done, ironically, everybody thinks we care so much about Cuba and the Iran deal. I think pulling out of TPP is just devastating. I think the Chinese have just a wide open field in Asia now, and they're doing their One Belt, One Road initiative, and they're setting the agenda. So I stand by the notion that it doesn't mean Russia and the Middle East aren't important, but it does mean that there has to be a bandwidth, a discipline about having bandwidth that you dedicate to Asia and to Latin America and to Africa. What's interesting about the foreign policy establishment critique is, you know, I think the blob and I have more in common in some ways than people might think, but also what I was saying can be misread. I was making a very specific point about the use of military force in the Middle East, and that that there was something, there was a vein of groupthink that somehow led to, you know, a narrowing of options to you show you care about something, you show your credibility by using military force. And I'm saying that in year 7 or 8 of administration, where I've seen us use force in Yemen, in Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. I mean, no shortage of it. And yet the critique is always, you know, why aren't you doing more in that space? On Syria, for instance, one of the things I wrestle with is it's always framed as, should we have used force or should we have armed people? Well, was there a diplomatic option that we missed in 2011 and 2012? Like, could we have constructed something? Could we have worked that more aggressively at the outset? So that's my critique. The flip side of that is...
But I just have to interrupt.
Yeah.
But do you feel like the critique overall of the establishment, does it look a little bit different now that, you know, we have something so out of the box?
Well, yes, but that goes in both directions. I mean, I remember, Susan, because we were seen as just, you know, way outside the, you know, these huge breaks from, I mean, I can turn that inside out and say, some people were acting like, and there's voiceovers in the film that I actually enjoy hearing. It's like, yes, this is the end of the world and the West. And it's like, we're actually much closer to each other on the spectrum than to Trump. You know, I mean, we're all in the spectrum of we believe
That's exactly the point I'm making.
So I agree.
That it turns out when you're in the box, actually, you might think one end of the box is really far away from the other box, but now it turns out you were in the box.
We're all for the liberal international order,
and the Bush administration that you came to office, seeing yourself as a repudiation.
Well, I think I would continue to say that the Iraq War was way outside the box. I don't think that was in the I do think that. You know, some of the debates in 17 and by the time we got to 2015, 2016, it was like we weren't as far away. I mean, I'm making a specific point about, you know, military force in the Middle East, but we're all for a liberal international order. And actually, I've seen some Bob commentary, you know, that, well, the Bob is what built the liberal international order. And I'm like, I'm for that. I'm all for, you know, people who underpin the international order. I'm not for, you know, bleeding that down in wars in the Middle East. But I think I'm totally in agreement with the premise that, you know, we were not as far away from, we wanted to uphold that system. We just had some different ideas about how to prioritize doing that.
But we now have wings of both parties certainly a wing of the Democratic Party that likes, you know, tearing up the universe of the world. And so we do have...
Well, TPP was equally loathed
by
wings of both...
And as China puts together its 14-country, you know, trade pact, and as it's the very people who, you know, are hostile to the trade agenda that we put forward who will pay the price ultimately.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
I want to make sure I go back and, you know, there's a number of things that don't come up in this. And obviously, this is just a snippet of all the issues that you were encountering over the last year. But in the vantage point of 2018, there's no discussion really of North Korea, for example. Russia appears as this point of conflict over Syria, but there's no mention of the election hacking or the overall dilemma of whether and how to accommodate itself to Russia. President Obama's own arc of going from the reset to such a distance with President Putin that they weren't really even on speaking terms by the end. So as you look at it now, are there a couple things that you say, well, I wish we would have done them differently at the end? If we'd known that Trump was going to win, would we have done, you know, these two things differently?
Well, I would have ended our involvement in the war in Yemen, for starters. I think, you know, we, as Ben said, we tried to put the brakes on in different ways. We tried to use our leverage. But at a certain point, probably, you know, by midway through 2016, we should have recognized that our leverage was not sufficient to bring about the kind of change that we needed. Now, we still would have needed, you know, to defend against threats across international borders. We still need a strategy to contest Iranian aggression in the region, which was playing itself out in Yemen. But to be complicit in this way. And then when Trump takes over, he just dramatically increases the level of involvement now, notwithstanding, the loss of so many lives. So that's one example. I think that one thing that actually sort of surprises me and a little bit in a pleasing way about the last year is we could have, because we did not think that Trump would win, we could have let the Paris Agreement sort of come into force at its own pace. And one of the things that the film doesn't really capture, but that I think is amazing in retrospect, is that President Obama insisted we wage a full court press, you know, basically the equivalent of a full-on campaign in order to bring the treaty into force. Kyoto took 9 years to bring into force. We brought it in between December of 2015 and then before the November election. So that means that's an example of a piece of the infrastructure that was built in the international order that while America can leave it, well, he can't. I mean, America can leave, but China, India, all the other countries are still on the hook.
Okay. What about Russia, though? I got to ask about this. Do either of you feel any responsibility? Again, hindsight is 2020, but do you feel that it was a mistake in hindsight not to have been more proactive and forceful in laying out your evidence around Russia and the hacking?
I mean, it's hard for Sam and I actually really weren't in the heart of the decision making process on that.
That makes it easier for you to criticize it.
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, I guess, first of all, we thought when we made that statement on October 7th that it would be this really big deal. You know, we're the judgment of the whole U.S. intelligence community, Russia's meddling. And the Access Hollywood tape came out that night, and oh, gee, by coincidence, the Podesta email started to leak that night, and it just kind of got subsumed. I guess when I look back on it, I'll kind of frame this way I did Syria. Everybody focuses on should Obama have said more. I really do believe that if Obama's just out there talking about this more, then Trump just says this is rigged and it's a he said, she said thing. And I think it assumes too much capacity by the U.S. government to affect kind of how information is consumed to think that we could have, because the biggest problem was, you know, the sharing of fake news. And we can't go on everybody's Facebook page and say, actually, you're reading something created by a Russian bot. You know, I do think if you look at the arc of it, you could see Russia developing this capacity in Ukraine and using it to disseminate fake news. I spent a lot of...
Including against the United States and its diplomats.
Yeah, and I spent a lot of my time in 14 and 15 in the information space wrestling with that from a foreign policy perspective. Like, how do we work with Europeans to prevent the Baltics from succumbing to Russian information operations? And the conversation that had to happen and that still has to happen with the tech sector, with Facebook and with news platforms, I think we were having that conversation on ISIS, but I do think that so much of this is outside of what people understand is so much of this is outside of the control of the government. We can't stop this information from being shared online. There's not a U.S. government response that can say, we could say it's happening, but we can't, you know, block certain, you know, Twitter bots and news sources. And so what needs to happen is a real dialogue between the U.S. government and Facebook and Twitter and other tech platforms about how to deal with this. We had that conversation about terrorism over because it's been going on for 10 years. That conversation could have started earlier. I don't know if that would have made a difference. So that is, you know, something I think about. The only other thing I'd say is on TPP, you know, the timing, we just missed it. I mean, it just slipped too far to the right. And by the time that was ready to be presented to Congress, like, Donald Trump was shaping the Republican primary and we weren't going to get a vote. And so we're hoping that we'll get that in the lame duck if Hillary wins and try to figure something out. Given the importance that I was talking about, I mean, I think having more of an accelerant on that effort could have potentially protected that.
So, Samantha, just quickly on Russia, your view about whether there could have been more done.
Well, because I think the damage being done now to everything that matters to my children and their eventual children is so great. I am just, my personality is such that, of course, I think, I mean, if we knew then that not only that Trump would win, you know, with all kinds of nudges of support from the Russian government, but also that he would then do the set of things that he has done as president and so damaging to the interests of the American people, I think we'd have to ask ourselves, what more could we do? I think Ben's point is a really important one, is, you know, what were the things upstream, you know, well before the very specific understanding of meddling in the states and the very specific understanding of the kind of the information warfare and the leaking of emails and stuff associated with the campaign. But was there a two-year plan, right, where we went all in on the, you know, the kind of conversations that are happening now, frankly, that I don't think the administration is initiating, but that are getting initiated by public demand with Facebook, Twitter, with, you
Putin
know, the whole...
invaded Crimea in 2014.
I never even understood, I don't even think I'd heard the phrase in the modern context, fake news, until after fake news had already, you know, had the kind of impact that we know that, I think it was President Obama, in fact, at a press conference where I was like, fake news, So even when we were having the debates internally about what to do, I think we're very focused on the leaking, the cyber dimension of it, but the lying and the way in which the lies were permeating,
like
the
propaganda
reach,
nature of
the
information
reach of, the reach of those lies. I think if we knew then what we know now, we would have at least been
and we didn't know.
Trying
I mean,
to bring in those stakeholders.
The fact is, we didn't see that scale until after the election. Yeah.
So we could have this conversation literally on and on, which would be great. And I hope you'll come back and we can talk about Syria. We can do a Russia episode. But I'm very grateful to both of you for sharing this time with us. President Obama, should he be speaking out more right now? I'm sure this is what everybody wants to know from you, but where is he? Why isn't he speaking out?
You know, I think that, he, you know, as a former president, he still abides by norms. I mean, that's, you know, who he is. I mean, he's the person who's going to live the norms. So he's respectful of that. He's speaking out sparingly when, you know, certain lines are crossed or certain kind of foundational things like healthcare are threatened. But also, I think he takes a very long view of history, and yeah, he's got 30 years ahead of him, and he'll have to speak out at certain points. And if he goes into the news cycle and the kind of knife fight, it actually kind of diminishes him when he does speak out, right? So I think he is mindful of the fact that he's not playing in 2 and 4 year increments anymore. He's someone who's relatively young, and so therefore has decades of hopefully some influence on debates. And the, in a way, the less he speaks, the more it will matter when he does.
I want to thank both of you. When are your books coming out?
Oh, don't ask
that. Yeah, terrible. I have one that I haven't written either. Yeah. But the movie is coming out next week, the final year, and it really is worth watching. And this has been a great conversation. Ben Rhodes, Samantha Power, thank you, of course, to our listeners on the Global Politico. I think it's having a great audience as well as great guests. That's the reason that we were named the Best Politics Podcast of 2017. But I want to thank all of you for listening, and you can always email me at sglasser@politico.com. And thanks again to Samantha Power and Ben Rhodes.
Thanks.
Thank you.